Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Bacon Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking to the folks from the Earthworks Institute about a new climate change conservation corps that is happening here in New Mexico. I'm very happy now to welcome documentary filmmaker David Novak. His new film, Burning the Future, Coal in America, is screening tomorrow night, Wednesday the 17th of March at 7 o'clock at the Santa Fe Farmers Market. And you will be here, David Novak, for a discussion after the movie. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
That's right. Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here.
So one of the things that I think is important to talk about before we get into the details of your work in West Virginia, which is where this documentary was made, or where a lot of it was shot, is the simple fact of coal's contribution to the electricity supply in the United States and to global warming. Tell us about those two things.
Sure. And, you know, I'll tell you from my own point of view, it was staggering for me to find out about, about 7 years ago now, that coal-fired power plants generate more than half the electricity in this country. And growing up in New York City, I had no idea. You know, one thinks that their electricity just comes from the wall because that's where it comes from,
right?
Or a local power plant, which, you know, here in New York City, they've been converted away from coal for many, many years now. But it turns out that, you know, we're all tapped into these giant grids, and the electrons are flying all over the country. And sure enough, half of our electricity is coming from coal-fired power plants. I started asking my friends 7 years ago when I discovered this if they knew. And, you know, these are all reasonably educated, well-read, kind of tapped into the news cycle people, and no one had any clue that the numbers were that high. We all thought it was something more of the Victorian age and that you know, maybe there was 10 to 15% of coal-fired power at this point. But we were very, very wrong about that. And I think that certainly since the last presidential election, energy has come into the conversation nationally in a way that many more people are aware of the contribution that coal makes to our electricity. The other side of the coin is the contribution, as you mentioned, to climate change. And it varies a little bit year to year, and with the economy, the new figures haven't come out yet, but roughly a third, usually a little bit more, of the carbon dioxide that the United States puts out is coming from coal-fired power plants. So they are our number one source. If you're looking at just one thing that is generating all of that carbon dioxide, it's about equal to all of the cars on the road in the country. In fact, the entire transportation system, not just the cars.
And so it really makes it a huge, responsibility for citizens, first of all, to know where their electricity is coming from. And if you're going to conserve energy, it makes a lot of sense to start turning things off in your house as opposed to, you know, not using your car or other things like that. I mean, this film really helps to put those things in proper proportion.
Yeah, thank you. And it was very important to me to draw that line, that sort of power line, if you will, that connects our light switches and microwaves and dryers and everything electric in the house to coal-fired power plants. It's a leap of faith to kind of understand that without really living it, but it's clear, and I think I draw it pretty clearly in the film. The folks who come see the film will see that the characters from West Virginia do make their way to New York to attend a conference at the United Nations. And during that trip, they walk into Times Square at night. And knowing what kind of electricity is burning in Times Square, and they living the hazards of the extraction of that electricity on a daily basis, you can imagine their sentiments as they walk through Times Square at night.
Well, that was one of the scenes in the film that really struck me. The film introduces a whole world of people in West Virginia who are basically one of the Appalachian states that where most of the coal that we use in this country comes from, a very huge amount of it. Tell us about the type of mining that is going on there right now, mountaintop mining.
Yeah, the coal focuses on mountaintop mining. Coal, to give your listeners a bit of an explanation, the coal, we think of it as being underground, and it is underground. It can be as much as a mile and a half deep underground. But there's also coal in the mountains going up from the valleys. And in Appalachia, in West Virginia, that part of Kentucky, pieces of North Carolina, Virginia, Tennessee, people live in the valleys, and there are mountains up above them. And those mountains have layers of coal with rock between them. It's kind of like a layer cake. So it goes coal, rock, coal, rock, coal, rock. So there's a lot of coal that's actually above where people live. And mining that coal is a little problematic. What was invented sometime in the 80s on a small scale and in the last 10 years has taken off tremendously is this form of mining called mountaintop removal coal mining. And in mountaintop removal coal mining, the engineers figured out that the best way to get at this coal and not waste it would be to clear cut the trees, which then simply get dumped into the valleys below, and then plant explosives to blow up the layers of rock, exposing a seam of coal beneath. And when the rock blows up, you can imagine that this has been compacted earth and minerals and rock for millennia, and blowing them up, they take up something like three times the volume that they originally took up. So they have to put it somewhere. And that gets pushed off into the valleys as well, and they build these kind of giant retaining walls, which are called valley fills from this material. And that leaves a seam of coal exposed. They can come in with bulldozers, scoop up the coal, remove all of it, 100% of it, and send it off for processing. That process, the whole process, is mountaintop removal coal mining. They literally are removing the mountains to get at the coal.
Now, this has many ramifications. I think it's a very fair documentary because you bring in people from the coal industry and show the case that they are making. And one of the cases that they make is that once the mountains are removed, then forests grow back and there's some kind of restoration. To what extent is that or is that not true?
Well, yeah, restoration. So they called it reclamation, and that's how in the surface mining laws is what has to happen. You have to reclaim the land, and that means to restore the land to an equal or better use than it was originally. And here's what happens. They push some soil back on top, what they can, but there's very little topsoil left, hardly anything. And they spray it with a foreign kind of, I think it's genetically engineered, species of grass that can grow in very, very dry conditions. Because without the layers of soil and without the root infrastructure that was there when there was a forest standing there, there's no water retention, very, very little water retention. So only things that can really survive in a dry climate are able to thrive there. So it becomes a different ecosystem, and you wouldn't recognize it. I mean, it looks a little more like a desert golf course in a way. Certainly not quite as pretty, but it looks a little more like a desert golf course than a forest that is, in fact, one of the most biologically diverse forests on the planet.
That was something I didn't know, that it's that the Appalachian forests are the second most biodiverse in the world next to the Amazon rainforest.
That's correct. I think there's a similar forest in China, probably where the coal mining areas are in China. These forests, they're not quite like the temperate rainforest that you have in the Pacific Northwest, but they're almost rainforest, and there are little pockets that actually technically you can call a rainforest because of the amount of moisture that they get. But they're more similar to the tropical rainforest in biodiversity. Incredible numbers of species of hardwoods and then amphibians and birds and migratory birds, and the list goes on and on and on. And I believe it's the oldest mountain range on the planet, or one of the oldest mountain ranges on the planet. It was formed when what's now the North American continent collided with what is now the African continent to form Pangaea, and these mountains popped up, and that was the beginning of the Appalachian Mountains.
So the effects, both human and ecological, from the type of mountaintop coal mining that's going on are vast, and you spent a good amount of the time of the documentary on this. One of the things that happens is flooding. And that's because, I guess, because the water, there's no longer any soil to absorb the water, and suddenly human areas, human population areas get flooded.
That's correct. And, you know, in the valleys there, or the hollers, as they call them, in Appalachia, flooding was always an issue. When there are very, very, very heavy rains, there's typically floods in valleys down below. But they had grown accustomed to knowing the patterns of flooding, when the floods would come, what areas of the ground would typically be flooded out. And with generations of living on that land, people had adapted very well to those normal flood events. What's happened without the topsoil and the trees and the shrubs and everything that's up on top of those mounds, with it being removed, is that you end up with, it's like, someone once described it to me as like a granite tabletop. And as all of that rainwater lands on that granite tabletop, it's got to eventually spill off somewhere. And when that comes down the valley fills and into the valleys, whole towns have been washed away. It's very different from any flooding event that they had seen before. And they have been getting, over the last decade, what you would call a 100-year flood or a 50-year flood, time and time and time and time again. It was an interesting statistic. I'd have to read up on it again, to be honest. But back in 06, West Virginia had received more FEMA flood dollars than anywhere in the U.S., something like for 5 years running, until Hurricane Katrina happened.
In addition to that, you have another huge problem, which is that the streams are either totally polluted or they're completely buried, so that part of people's both culture and livelihood is ruined. So you can't fish from the streams anymore, and a lot of people really have lost their culture that they've been living for generations, if not centuries.
That's right. I mean, you can't fish, you can't swim, or you certainly don't want to let your kids swim in that water. I think of Maria Gonneau, who's really the hero of the film, and really my personal hero, Maria. She's so wonderful. She grew up, she's still on the property that she grew up on, raising her kids on that property. And she's had floods come down and rip through and destroy her property. She almost lost her house. She's lost her pets to the floods. And the stream that used to run by her house is now a pollution discharge spillway. By federal standards, she can't use it. She would want to use it, but she can't use it because there are retaining ponds up above her property that are meant to prevent some of the worst things from coming down off the mountain. And those retaining ponds have flocculants and other chemicals in it that, you know, humans should not be touching and should not be ingesting. And that's coming right down through her property. So, yeah, it's very much part of their livelihood. You know, we tend to think of people in Appalachia as being hillbillies and as being poor. And there certainly are poor people in the mountains, and there are certainly people who are less educated than the rest of the country in the mountains for a host of reasons we could discuss on a different show. But they also have been raised knowing how to live off the land and knowing how to allow the land to supplement their lives. And it's a way of life that's very, very important to them, and that is being taken away.
There's also the not only not being able to live off the land, but the water that comes out of the ground, comes into their wells and so on, is so polluted that we saw some of the examples of this during the film. It's black. It's sludge. It's absolutely disgusting.
Yeah, and you know, the black water goes to another issue around coal that, truthfully, happens whether you're using mountaintop mining or not. No matter how coal is being taken out of the ground, it goes through a washing process. This process is meant to remove a good portion of the heavy metals, and it's a mechanical process, but they also use more and more chemicals in this process as well. And what's left over, because it's kind of, it's a wet process, it's a liquid process, what's left over is a sludge, kind of like a thick, almost pudding consistency liquid that gets dumped into sludge fills or sludge impoundment ponds. And these ponds are also up above the valleys. If you can imagine, they need a place to put all of this stuff. What they do is they take spoil from mountaintop mining and they create a retaining wall, kind of plugging up the top end of a valley, leaving a hole big enough to fill it in and create this toxic lake of sludge. And that's what they do. That's what the sludge impoundments are. I mean, many of these have more than 1 billion gallons of sludge. And some of them are precariously positioned just upstream from schools, from towns, from neighborhoods. And there are impoundment failures from time to time that are disastrous. In the 70s, there was one that killed, I think it was 126 people in Buffalo Creek. And there have been smaller ones since. And every year, there are one or two in the news, but they're pretty much marginalized into local news. And that leaks down into the groundwater. In fact, in some instances, that's even getting pumped down into old, empty underground mines to make room up on top to pipe in more sludge. And that gets into groundwater. So when we have black water events, when we have people actually consuming dirty water, I mean, you can look at it and you see in the film, it looks rusty. You know, it's horribly dirty water. That's what the source of that kind of water is. It's from these coal slurry impoundments that, as I mentioned before, happen whether you're using mountaintop mining or traditional mining.
And there's a great irony there, which is that the coal that is being burned cleaner because of the requirements of the Clean Air Act, but it's not cleaner for the people of Appalachia. It's cleaner for the rest of us who aren't there.
That's exactly right, and that's one of the things we all have to think about when we talk about externalizing costs. So when we talk about things like clean coal, it's not clean. Where does the stuff go? It goes somewhere. It doesn't just disappear magically. There's nothing clean about clean coal.
We're talking to filmmaker David Novak about his documentary Burning the Future, Coal in America, which is screening at the Santa Fe Farmers Market tomorrow night at 7 in the evening. So you've got dirty water, the mountains where people lived and hunted and bathed and carried out their, you know, sustainable survival culture, the mountains themselves gone, biodiverse forest being cut away. It's starting to make the old days of union busting and black lung look like the good old days.
That's right. Those were the good old days. You know, I interviewed three miners. Just because you mentioned unions, I interviewed three miners. I didn't use this in the film, but I'm happy to share it with your listeners. They were non-union miners, and I interviewed them in silhouette, and I promised I would change their voices and not use their names because they were spilling their guts to me about what really goes on underground in the non-union mines. And it's abysmal. And there's still a lot of union busting going on in Appalachia. One of the things that happens is a mine that's a union mine will declare bankruptcy, no longer pay out pension because they've declared bankruptcy, and 6 months later, it's opened up by new mine operators as a non-union mine, and they hire the same people back because those are people who are out of jobs and they need to work. So in an area that was by far a majority of union workers, I believe it's down to something like 35% union now in the underground mines.
So you have people like Maria Gonneau, who is featured in your film, and she is a woman whose family has lived there for centuries in West Virginia, whose only goal in life when she was young was to be a mother, which she was, but then she became a community organizer. Tell us a little bit about her story.
Well, Maria was kind of forced into this work. She was raised in a family of miners. Her grandfather, I believe it was Cherokee, so she's mixed blood, which is very, very common in Appalachia. And it was through his family that she learned so much about stewardship over her land and how to use her land to help sustain. She learned a lot of traditional medicines that she really can't access anymore because the woods behind her house just don't have anything growing in them anymore because the mountains are gone. So Maria was raising her children on her property, and she had a flood. She had another flood. There was blasting going up behind her house, but it wasn't all that close. And it actually took a couple of years for her to really figure out, by talking with her neighbors, what was going on. And a neighbor, where she lives, a neighbor could be the person who's kind of next door, just down the street or just down the stream a little bit. But a neighbor could also be somebody who is up over the trail, up the mountain. You go all the way up a hollow, up over the mountain, and come down into another hollow on the other side, and there's going to be another pocket of homes. And they would be neighbors, too. They would go up, and they would pick berries together up on the tops of the mountains and things like that. She could no longer get at those people. She had to drive around to get to them, and it's a far way to drive around. So these mining sites were actually, you know, separating neighbors and separating communities that used to be cohesive communities. So all of this is starting to feed into Maria's sense of disconnection and something going on, and she started to dig in to what was going on town after town after town, and she began to get a sense of the scale of it. And she heard about a volunteer pilot organization called South Wings. And South Wings, they're based in North Carolina, and they take people, mostly press and government officials, on environmental flyovers. And she got in touch with them, and they took her up in a plane. And she saw from the air what was going on and the scale of it, and it completely changed her life. She came back down on the ground. She started working as a community organizer. She didn't call herself that. She was simply going about letting her neighbors know what was going on, starting to do research. She got hooked up with the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, who they were already working in this area, and started volunteering for them. And ultimately, she had to quit her job as a waitress and become a community organizer as her full-time job because her work in organizing was 16 hours a day before her waitressing, and she was a single mom raising kids. Maria is just my hero, and she is working tirelessly. She's now driving around the state with her guard dogs, because she has her life threatened very frequently. Gunshots heard above her home, things like that. We can get into that a bit later. And she drives around the state and goes into communities where she knows the coal mining companies are pitting neighbor against neighbor, because she's been through that herself. And she's unifying those communities. She's working right now very much in a town called Twilight, where that's exactly what's going on. The mining company is trying to just get rid of them because they want that hollow. They want that valley because it's between two mountaintop mining sites, and they want to just be able to blast straight through it. And she's working with them to preserve their community. It's a tireless job, and she really is a hero.
It's a very tough situation that she and the people around her are in, because I was thinking about this compared to other human rights struggles. This is certainly a human rights struggle. For example, if you have women's rights or gay rights, if people fight for their rights and get them, the economy doesn't change. But if coal companies were to have to take responsibility for the absolute havoc that they are wreaking on cultures and human beings and ecosystems and so on, they would either have to stop doing what they're doing completely, and we do not have, unfortunately, an alternative energy grid in place, or they would have to pay for it, which would mean energy prices would go up hugely if they want to keep making their huge profits. It's a very tough problem.
You know, it is, And it's not as tough as it sounds, and I'll tell you why. The mountaintop mining nationally only accounts for a very small percentage of our coal. And it's easily argued that that we could do away with mountaintop mining immediately. As far as the local economy goes with mountaintop mining, when underground mining was the only way to mine, and really as recently as only 20 years ago, there were 120,000 miners in Appalachia, maybe in West Virginia alone. I forget that stat. I think it's for West Virginia. There are now only 15,000 because mountaintop mining requires many, many fewer people to work per ton of coal. So one can argue that to return to underground mining, I think it's about 50-50 now, underground and mountaintop in that area. If we could end mountaintop mining immediately, the worst thing about our coal industry today would just be gone, and that could be done without drastically affecting the economy of West Virginia and Kentucky. Second to that is this liquid processing that I was talking about with the coal slurry. There is a dry technique. I've been told that it costs $1 a ton more to use this dry technique. And I don't know where they would put whatever waste is done with that, but certainly to have lined impoundments and a dry technique would cost only a little bit more than what it does now. Why that's not done, given the cost, given the externalized cost, I just can't believe that it's not done at this point. So, yeah, it's true, and that's the story that is spun very, very strategically by the coal companies to the mining community in West Virginia, that these people are out to take your jobs, these people are out to destroy our economy. It isn't quite all a doomsday scenario for the economy there if we're to move away at least from mountaintop mining and liquid coal slurry impoundment. And that brings up the bigger issue. If we're going to get off of coal in order to tackle our contribution to global warming, then we have something we have to really talk about with, as far as Appalachia is concerned. How are we going to transfer that economy into another economy so that people can still stay there and live there and work there and have jobs beyond coal? And there are a lot of proposals out for that. The rail infrastructure and river infrastructure is incredible there. Tourism is great. The rail infrastructure can provide easy access to light manufacturing of wind turbines and solar panels and any part of a green energy economy that could be worked there. There's a lot of skilled labor. There's a lot of trainable labor. So it seems like it's a big problem, but it really is not an insurmountable problem by any stretch.
One of the main problems, of course, is the extreme power of the coal industry. And as you point out in your film, every time there was a lawsuit or any challenging to the coal companies, which were actually breaking rules, environmental rules and so on, the Bush administration would just change the rules.
They have an awfully strong lobby. And, you know, the coal lobby is the utility lobby. They're really one lobby. And then to some extent, they're the energy lobby, depending on what it is that's being tackled. They put $35 million into a clean coal campaign. And I'm sure all of your listeners were subject to the same ads on television in New Mexico that I was subject to in New York. One of the things that blew me away was this clean coal campaign during the CNN presidential primary debates before the last presidential election.
Right.
The entire debates were sponsored by the coal lobby. Wasn't that mind-boggling?
Yes, indeed. Well,
and there was very little discussion of climate change in those debates.
Yeah, exactly. No, this is a big problem, and as many people have said, the biggest, fastest, easiest way to clean up the environment is campaign finance reform.
Yeah.
But that's another conversation.
Yeah.
David Novak, I have to...
talk about that tomorrow night.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I have to say that about 10 minutes into your film, I put the film on pause, got up, and turned out every light in my house.
Excellent.
Yes, because we, of course, are, when we plug our appliances into our walls here in New Mexico, we're also burning coal. It's just about time to go, but David Novak is a documentary filmmaker, and his film is called Burning the Future, Coal in America. It's screening at the Santa Fe Farmers Market Pavilion tomorrow, Wednesday the 17th of March, at 7 in the evening. And the website is burningthefuture.org, and David Novak will be here. It'll be great to meet you and to have a discussion after the film.
I'm so looking forward to it. It'll be terrific. I also want your listeners to know that John Fogarty from New Energy Economy in New Mexico is going to be there. So we're going to bring the discussion full circle and talk about coal-fired power in New Mexico as well.
Excellent. David Novak, thanks for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. Have a good one.
You too. I'm happy now to welcome Jan Willem Janssens. He's the executive director of Earthworks Institute. And we are also joined by three others from Earthworks. Sig Silber is a board member. Dana Richards is the director of the 4C program, which we're about to talk about. Tyler Perrone is a 4C crew member. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
So, Jan Willem, this is an important program for the community to know about, which is why we're giving you a little time today. Tell us about this 4C Climate Change Conservation Corps. Those are what the 4Cs stand for.
Yeah. Thank you, Mary Charlotte. 4C, the Climate Change Conservation Corps, was established actually by Dana a year and a half ago in our organization as a brand new program to provide workforce development in green color pathways to people here in northern New Mexico, and to weave that program basically into all our work of community stewardship and attention to issues of mitigation of climate change impacts.
So what do you actually, Dana, do in the program? How did you conceive of it?
Well, actually, about 10 years ago, I was a supervising teacher for a master teacher, for a student teacher in Sacramento in California. And I was observing her teaching science at Sacramento High. And it happened to be a day when there was a whole bunch of junior ROTC activity at the school. And I noticed the uniforms and the sense of pride and community and connectedness around the ROTC program there. And I realized then that there wasn't a moral equivalent of war, so to speak, another option for young people to raise their hand and say, hey, I want to be heroic. I want to be self-sacrificing. I want to do something that helps the earth, helps address equity issues. And so that was the moment when I said, that's the next chapter in my life, to devote myself to developing a moral equivalent of war, an alternative for young people to engage in solutions, to connect with their own inner sense of hope and possibility, and specifically to address issues of climate change and all the surrounding issues. So
it sounds
that's
a little
moment.
Like the Peace Corps, only for climate.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure, Peace Corps, VISTA, the old Civilian Conservation Corps, AmeriCorps, they all have aspects of that same intention. Even Habitat for Humanity in some ways carries that same spirit.
So what actual activities are you doing on the ground?
We have five, what we've identified as five career pathways: energy efficiency and renewable energy, green architecture, planning and building. We have a local food piece. We have a land and water health, like restoration projects. And then we have education and community mobilization. So all of our work fits into those five pathways. We do things like create edible schoolyards and outdoor learning spaces and community
edible
gardens.
Edible schoolyards. So you eat the jungle gym?
That sounds pretty good. Yeah, we make gingerbread jungle gyms. No, you may know that this generation of young people spends more time indoors, more time in front of screens than any other generation in history, with some serious health consequences and serious deficiencies. In fact, you may have heard the term nature deficit disorder,
yes,
right?
Yes, indeed.
So we're trying to address that by creating outdoor learning spaces and at the same time create places at schools and in communities to grow food to increase local food security.
So, Tyler, you are a member of the crew. How long have you been doing it, and what are you actually doing? What are some of your activities?
Well, I can't remember the exact date. It's been probably about a year and a half since Dana came to the Institute of American Indian Arts, came into my English Comp 2 class, and handed out some, applications. And I looked into it. Myself and about two other classmates applied and got in. It was for, we were taking about maybe a weekend every month for about, about 6 months.
Yeah, 8 months.
8 months. Mm-hmm. And we're going off and spending like the weekend with each other and going over like green curriculum and just talking about different ideas and, you know, coming together and just spending time out there, like outdoors and in these places, just talking about these kind of things. And that's where it started. And then I eventually got on with the crew during last summer, and we got to do a lot of, outdoor classrooms and community gardens and restoration work in the Cerritos Hills and, you know, in El Dorado and Turquoise Trail Elementary. And, actually, we just had a lot of fun. I learned a lot of stuff about carpentry, you know, and construction, laying drip line irrigation. And also, you know, I wanted to have something backing that with that. And I was learning a lot of, you know, more of the details, the nitty gritty of, you know, going green, that kind of thing.
Now, are you engaging with the, for example, when you go to an elementary school with the kids also?
Yeah, actually, we did at the high school, Monte del Sol. We worked with some of the students there.
You're teaching them also what you're learning about?
Yeah. It's all kind of a group project. And we also worked on a lot of murals. And the mural over there at Monte del Sol actually came from the students' ideas. They laid it out, and we pretty much put it on the panels for them. So it was their idea, and that was like kind of a good cooperative work.
Tyler also participated. We have a weatherization program that targets low and moderate income residences in Santa Fe County, and Tyler was one of our weatherization crew members as well. So,
the weatherization, there's a number of groups that are doing that. We talked about YouthWorks, EnergyWorks program. You're doing really a similar thing.
That's correct. Actually, we are part of the EnergyWorks program. That was a collaboration with the Sierra Club. And well, it is still ongoing, basically. So we've worked with the Sierra Club to partner in identifying low-income homes in Santa Fe where weatherization is what was necessary, and also in coordination with Los Amigos here in town. And so then our crew went to the homes that were canvassed for this kind of work to implement the weatherization techniques.
If somebody, for example, is from a middle income or higher income home but still lives in a drafty old adobe that's leaking heat out all over the place, can they still get the services or pay for the services?
Yeah, we actually have another arm of our weatherization work. It's called the Carbon Busters, and we've been working a lot in El Dorado because on the one hand, there are serious equity issues, and if you're familiar with the work of, say, Van Jones, that's something that, you know, we're really aligned with. There's also a pure carbon footprint issue, and so suburban and more affluent residences have big carbon footprints, and so that's something we want to address too. So we helped develop something called Carbon Busters, and our 4C
crew. It sounds like you've got huge lumps of coal and you're smashing them.
Yeah, that would be great. In the long run, we absolutely hope to be pulling coal out of the energy stream through some of this efficiency work and renewable work. So absolutely. Carbon Busters uses the crew and uses volunteers to do audits and assessments. And we can, on a fee-for-service basis, do weatherization for families that don't qualify for the low-income requirements for subsidized weatherization.
Sig Silber, what's your role?
Well, I'm a member of the board, and I'm also the treasurer, so my role is to try to have this program be as sustainable as possible, to be able to continue as long as possible, and possibly to broaden to include more communities and more crew members. Part of that is getting funding from organizations. We have 12 organizations now that are providing funding. A third of them are government agencies, a third charitable foundations, and a third other partners. And so one request I would have would be, if there are people who feel that they may be able to introduce us to an organization where they're a member that might be interested in being a contributor, we'd be interested in that. Also, there's the challenge of funding the education of the crew members at the Santa Fe Community College. And so we're looking for people that want to adopt a crew member. $250 covers the additional cost of each additional crew member at the Santa Fe Community College. So anyone who's interested in adopting a crew member can call Dana at 690-5500.
And you can also go to earthworksinstitute.org. So, Tyler, you're a student at the Institute of American Indian Arts.
Yes.
Where are you from originally?
I'm from the Tule River Reservation in Central Valley, California.
So, among Indian people, for example, at the Institute of American Indian Arts and where you come from, how are people thinking about basically conservation and green education and things like that?
Well, I think in a traditional standpoint it comes naturally from, it's taught to us from our grandparents on and forth, you know, and there's a lot of, indigenous people at the school that aren't raised in that manner. And I think it's important that it gets brought back. And there's a sustainability committee at the school right now. And it's just barely getting started and rolling. But there's some different things going on with, like, gardens and stuff. And just trying to, create awareness. And I notice a lot of the different English classes are tackling some of these subjects and talking about it. And I think that, the awareness is really needed for, these students, especially some that don't come from a, tribal community. That are indigenous, but say urban indigenous.
Exactly.
Yeah,
we're actually really excited. IAIA is one of our project sites this year for 4C, and so IAIA has bold plans to meet climate change challenges and to really beef up the sustainability and green education, including building a green facility and having that be a class that students can take. And so we're real excited about our partnership with IAIA and that it's one of our sites this year for the crew to work at.
Now, Dana, you were talking about wanting this to be something that instead of going to a war-like path as a student, you could go to a peaceful and conservation path. Is this something that is happening on a national level?
Yeah, actually it is. And for 30 years now, there have been little pieces of the puzzle, but in the last 5 or 10 years, there's been a big renaissance and a lot more publicity. And I think we have, I say Van Jones, but Van Jones is a symbol for a lot of other folks articulating a new vision of energy security and energy independence and bold action in the face of the threats that climate change poses, and linking environmental restoration with social and community restoration, with equity issues. So the people that and the land that's been left out of the fossil fuel era are number one priorities for what we hope is a new era of ecology.
What do you mean land that's been left
well,
out?
Well, nature has suffered in the fossil fuel era, so as have communities of color and economically disadvantaged communities. So we're trying to heal both the land and the social fabric of our country and our planet. And climate change is both a serious threat, but it's also the opportunity and the occasion and the catalyst to re-engage our values around those things.
For more information, people can go to earthworksinstitute.org, call 505-982-9806. Jan Willem Janssens, Executive Director of Earthworks. Anything that you want to let people know before we go?
Well, we are just very thankful for all the broad community support we've had in the last year. And we're still looking out for people who want to contract with us to do this work on a fee-for-service basis, people who want to actually join the crew in the future or support us in any way we can. And we also would really like to underscore that this is a partnership project, as Sig suggested. we're working at least with a dozen partners, and that doesn't even include all the schools yet that we're
And you're
involved
so
with.
Good at that. Whenever so we've had you on the air in the past, you have a way of bringing together so many different communities with different interests.
Yes, and actually this program took off so quickly because we grafted it totally on all the other partnerships. So it's included now in our Earth Action Education program with schools, in our Water and Land Health program, and even in our policy program, because like last year, we partnered with Vision Shift, a collaborative of groups led by the New Energy Economy. We're also part of the National Core Network, and we're hoping to get a grant with them pretty soon to do case management for all our crew members so that we actually put them on a career and educational pathway so that we have, you could say, a follow-up strategy for them after that they have graduated from our crew for 1 or 2 years of, you could say, participation with us.
Jan Willem Janssen, Sig Silber, Dana Richards, and Tyler Perrone, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having us.
Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.